SciRam, dear listeners, welcome to this week's VideoSci Answering Booth. After a short unexpected break, I'm back with a fresh episode of this show. Show where you send me questions on practical spirituality and you and I together explore answers in Swami's message. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and I begin, as always, by offering my humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet. We had many, many questions on this show, and it has been quite a journey for me, and I hope all those who have traveled along have benefited too. I have another question today on a practical doubt in one's spiritual sadhana. Well, of course, I have answers based on Swami, and as Swami has said in many occasions. But before that, it's that segment of the show when I literally impose on each one of you a quote that has caught my fancy. The quote I wish to read for you today is actually a short poem. It's probably not one you would have heard of or read before. The poem is written by a person by name Digona Das. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that name right. Does the author really have to be well known? Well, it does. He really doesn't have to be. This poem is sweet and profound, and that's good enough. And more than that, it's mischievously and sarcastically drives an important lesson. So, dear listeners, let me first read for you this poem. I quote, "When you're feeling high and mighty, and your ego is supreme, when you feel like the king of Blighty and everybody's dream, just pause and think this over. You're not an irreplaceable bloke. You're not as rare as three-leaf clover. You're less useful than cloak. Take a bucket, fill it with water from the rains, and dip your hands to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that remains measures how much you will be missed. When you entered this world, you cry and you turn. You stir up a messy score. But when you go, you will be amazed to learn that world's quite the same as before. The moral, it's quite so clear, is to do the best service you can, be humble and just wipe off a tear, and don't think you're an indispensable man." End of quote. Yeah, that is the poem, dear listeners, and quite quirky, isn't it? It speaks of how sometimes we are given to enormous self-importance, forgetting that we are way too insignificant in the larger scheme of things. And this happens especially when we're being praised and celebrated. That's why the poet says, when you're feeling high and mighty and your ego is supreme, when you feel like the king of Blighty in everybody's dream. And it is when we feel this way we need to remind ourselves how insignificant we really are, how minuscule our contributions really are. And he says, just pause and think this over. You're not an irreplaceable bloke. You're not as rare as three-leaf clover. You're less useful than cloak. We must remind ourselves that we are not irreplaceable. As Krishna commanded Arjuna, nimitta matram bhava. Be just an instrument. Be incidental. Believe, if not for me, the Lord would have accomplished it through someone else, maybe even in a far better manner. Interestingly, just this morning I saw a person who is trying to settle in Prashanti after his retirement. He wants an opportunity to serve here, which I thought was quite noble. But then he began saying, there are many mistakes in the modes of working here, and I feel I can help in setting things right. This place, Prashanti Nilam, needs some tweaking and correcting. That is what he said. How much we can really get carried away, isn't it, dear listeners? We are so full of ourselves that we think an ashram built by Swami from scratch requires us to come and transform it. Yes, there are many changes that need to be made, no doubt. I wouldn't disagree with that. But we must remember, if Swami chooses so, He may use us as instruments of change. And even that is not for the place, but for our own progress. How easily we can get carried away by our own ego. The other category is of people who are already working and contributing their time, energy and talent. Some start thinking, what will happen to this place if I'm not here? What will happen to Swami's project after me, or whatever one's field of contribution is? As the poet sarcastically says, we are not even as rare as three-leaf clover. I say sarcastic because the three-leaf clover is actually not rare. The four-leaf clover is the one that is rare. And when the poet says you're not even as rare as the common three-leaf clover, well, we better understand how special we are. Then comes the best analogy. He says, you want to know how replaceable you are? Fill a bucket with water and dip your hand in it. The hole that is formed when you remove your hand is how much you will be missed. And don't we all know there is no hole formed when you remove a hand from a bucket full of water? This is such a beautiful analogy, I feel. Yes, as long as our hands are in the water, it occupies space. It's a real definite presence. But when we draw out our hand, there is no mark whatsoever of your past presence or your present absence. That is how indispensable we are. Or rather, that is how dispensable we are. And this should be so much more obvious when we are involving ourselves in Swami's work. Swami needs nothing. Least of all, he needs us to accomplish what he wishes. Our duty is to remind ourselves that Swami is merely giving us an opportunity, and that's about all. And the one who benefits through this opportunity is me, is us. It is so important to keep ourselves grounded that way. But again, the note on which the poet ends his poem is so beautiful too. The moral, it's quite so clear. It is to do the best service you can, be humble and just wipe off a tear. And don't think you're an indispensable man. How profound. Don't claim you will change the world. Just be there to serve. Serve as much as you can. Wipe a tear if you can. And if we do that, we will redeem our lives. If God wishes to use us to bring a change, well, so be it. Even then, it is His will that accomplishes the change. And we will only be incidental. Nimitta matram, nimitta matram. So dear listeners, before I move on, permit me to read the entire poem by Digona Das, if that's what his name is, one more time. I quote, "When you're feeling high and mighty, and your ego is supreme, and you feel like the king of Blighty and everybody's dream, just pause and think this over. You're not an irreplaceable bloke. You're not as rare as three-leaf clover. You're less useful than cloak. Take a bucket, fill it with water from the rains, and dip your hands to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that remains measures how much you will be missed. When you enter this world, you cry and you turn, you stir up a messy score. But when you go, will you be amazed to learn that the world's quite the same as before? Its moral, it's quite so clear, is to do the best service you can, be humble and just wipe off a tear. And don't think you're an indispensable man." So today's question, dear listeners, is from a person who wishes to be anonymous, so we will not name that person, of course. And I'll be reading out the question myself. So this is the question. "Sairam Brother Prem, I have some questions about meditation and Namasmarana. I'm very, very confused. Let me explain my questions. My sadhana is recitation of the Gayatri Mantra, Namasmarana, meditation, and singing Tevaram. All these I recently started. Earlier, I used to pray by singing Kirtanams and Tevarams also. My Ishta Devata is Amman, or mother goddesses like Durga, Lakshmi, Saraswati, Gauri, Gayatri, and so on. Can I choose one of these to meditate upon, or should I do some other way? I am confused about this. How can I choose one form which represents all these? And what name should be my Namasmarana? Presently, I chant Om Shakti Om while I do Namasmarana. Is it right? My another question is, when I do my Gayatri Mantra recitation 108 times, I normally close my eyes. When I close my eyes, which form should I meditate upon? Can I choose Gayatri Mata? I'm confused that I have two forms, one for meditation and one for Gayatri Mantra recitation. Can you please clarify these and suggest some answers? I can then take these as from Swami himself. Thank you, Sairam." Well, that's interesting to have a question of that nature today, because as you heard in the morning show, today happens to be the anniversary of the meditation tree, and here we have a question on Namasmarana and meditation. That's quite interesting. Well, first and foremost, straight answer, unambiguous answer, there is no right and wrong in devotion at all. There is nothing like the right form to worship upon, the right name to chant upon. This is something which Swami constantly repeats through his many, many discourses. You can choose any form of your liking. You can choose any name of your liking. And you can meditate upon it and you can chant that name. All of that definitely reaches God, because in the truest sense, no one form is more powerful than the other. And that's because all forms are forms that we have attributed to God, because God is beyond all forms and beyond all qualities altogether, right? But this idea that, you know, the form I worship is greater than the form that you worship, or I should worship some other different deity, that my God is greater than your God. We all know that, you know, all the fights between religions and within religions, different sects within the religions, all of this come because of this idea that some worships or worshipping some deities are more powerful or more advanced than other forms of worship. So this is something which Swami has constantly told us, that is, it is not true. All forms are equal. All forms belong to the same God. And Swami would constantly say, Ekam Sat Vipra Bahudha Vadanti. He said, the truth is one. The learned ones chose to describe the truth in different ways. The same way, God is one, and we have attributed different names and forms to God. So it really does not matter which name and form that you would like to meditate upon. And even if we go back to our scriptures and if we go back to our mythological stories, you know, we constantly come across these many stories of how God has been worshipped in absolutely unconventional manners, and people have been able to win God's grace. There is nothing like there is a set pattern how you should do. We have the story of Kannappa, who, you know, worships God in his own way, which is absolutely blasphemous from the point of view of the priest. But he wins the grace of God as much as the priest himself gets the darshan of the Lord. So there is absolutely no strict way of doing things, especially when it comes to devotion. And I would probably suggest that I've answered two questions on a theme very similar to the question that's been asked here. One question was on, I meditate upon my guru instead of Swami's form, because this person learnt meditation under a different guru. But he said that now I'm devoted to Swami. Sometimes when I meditate, I'm confused. Am I supposed to imagine the form of my guru, or am I supposed to, imagine the form of Swami? So that was one question I answered. I think in that I'd covered completely about what Swami says about meditation and what are we supposed to do when we want to take up meditation as our sadhana. The other question was about someone who has been worshipping Swami for 20 years and somebody came along and told them that any form, any deity with form is only a lesser deity, can only be a guru or a demigod. The ultimate God is Parabrahman, is formless. So I'm confused. Am I wrong in worshipping Swami and thinking of Swami as a form when I meditate and do bhajans? That was the other question. I would very strongly suggest that the person who's asked this question can go back and listen to those two, because especially everything that has got to do with having a form and worshipping a form, I had spoken about in those two questions. I'll make a few references to what I'd said then. I'll repeat that here. But nevertheless, for a comprehensive understanding, I would suggest going back and listening to those. In answer to this particular question, that why do we really do this, you know, when we do a worship? Why is it that we give up one form of worship and try to take up another form of worship? Or we are worshipping a certain form and we try to take up another form and somebody tells us that, no, this is a more powerful form. Or we are chanting a certain mantra and somebody says, no, this mantra is more powerful, and we take up that. Why do we do that? Why do we look for that which is more beneficial? And I'll also explain why we have to stop doing that. It is not completely wrong that we are doing that, but at the same time, we have to transcend that stage. There's one thing which Swami says, I think he speaks of this in the Jnana Vahini. Swami says, the first step in spiritual journey, most of us turn to a spiritual journey because of a quality called Shubhecha, Swami says. That is the desire for self-welfare. That is what drives us to the spiritual journey. Swami says that, you know, we all are propelled to the spiritual path in search of this self-welfare. Because in the world, we don't find true happiness, we don't find lasting peace. So that is what actually eggs us to turn towards the spiritual path. From an outward path, we go to an inward path. And Swami says, from the Pravritti Marga to the Nivritti Marga, this change happens because of the Shubhecha, because we all want to progress. We want something better than what we already have. So in that sense, even when we take to a spiritual path, that is what propels us to go there. So when we are in the spiritual path, it is quite natural that we will be constantly seeing which is going to give me better returns, right? Just like how we do in business, we continue to do that because it's a natural thing. We say that I do Gayatri Japam, am I supposed to do something else? Someone else will come along and they'll say, no, I do Vishnu Sahasranamam, and then we'll be interested to do that. All of us have gone through that and all of us are going through that. You know, we always are interested in doing something which we feel is going to give us more benefit than we already are doing, right? But one thing which we must remember is any spiritual practice will eventually become perfect only when it is done with absolutely no eye on the results. And in fact, this is true for everything in life. As Swami would tell us, when you're in the path of karma, when you're in the path of doing dharmic actions, the best way to perform karma, Swami says, is to do nishkama karma. Doing karma without the eye on the results of your actions. Similarly, if you are taking the path of love, the path of seva, you're loving everybody around, you're doing service to everybody around, Swami says that love and that service becomes perfect only when it becomes selfless love and selfless service, which means you are not looking to gain something out of the act of loving and out of the act of serving, but you see the act of loving and serving itself as a reward. Same is the case with any other form of sadhana too. Swami has said this on many occasions, that when you do sadhana, you generally think that, what is the benefit I'm going to get? Am I going to get a vision? Am I going to get some siddhis? Am I going to get some sort of omniscient powers or whatever it is? But Swami would say that sadhana becomes perfect when you do sadhana for the sake of sadhana, which means the process itself you see as the reward and you don't look for a reward in the future. That is what makes sadhana perfect, right? But the thing is, it is quite difficult. As I said, everything that we do in the worldly path, in the spiritual path, is driven by this desire for self-welfare. When that is the case, how can you do something without an eye on the result? How can you take up an activity and do it wholeheartedly, saying that I'm not bothered about the result, I'm only bothered about doing it perfectly? And this is why Swami often says that in the path of devotion, this becomes very, very easy. Because when you're talking about the path of devotion, a devotee who takes up any of these sadhana that you mentioned, of singing kirtanas or singing, chanting the name of the Lord, he or she does not do it with the benefit in the mind, but it is an expression of their love for the Lord. You know, Mirabai wouldn't have sang songs on Krishna thinking that if I sing so many songs on Krishna, I will have this much spiritual progress. Nor would Tyagaraja would have written songs thinking that, if I can finish 1,000 kirtanas, then I will be this much more spiritually progressed. They did it out of the joy of doing it itself. Taking the name of the Lord gave them joy and they did it. And without the knowledge, they were actually doing perfect sadhana. You're doing sadhana without an eye on the results of the sadhana, but deriving all joy through the act of the sadhana itself. And that is why the path of devotion is very, very effective. Apart from the point that Swami would say that in the path of surrender, automatically the ego is discounted. So in that way, it is a very, very effective path. But apart from that, the other thing is this, that in the path of devotion, you can do perfect sadhana because you will do the sadhana for the joy of the sadhana, especially when you're talking about activities such as namasmarana, bhajans, kirtana, or even seva for that matter. All of these become perfect sadhana when you do it out of devotion. So even if you start by saying that I want benefit out of it and start a sadhana, over time we all must graduate to the point of doing that particular activity purely for the joy of doing that activity alone. And when that happens, the question is not which form is more beneficial to think of, which form is better to meditate upon, but which form, if I think of, I spontaneously feel love in my heart, right? So in devotion, there is no right and wrong. There is nothing like a less powerful form and a more powerful form, an effective method and a more effective method. And all these come into consideration only when you think of benefits that accrue through a spiritual sadhana. So at some point, we all must graduate beyond this, right? So I can say a very practical example I can give you is something like a mother trying to teach her small child, you know, some lessons or some good manners or something like that. You know, the mother derives immense joy by spending that time with the child. She is certainly doing something which is going to benefit the child. She has some better future in her mind when she's doing that. She wants to see her, child prosper in the future. There is definitely a certain amount of, as Swami would say, you're sowing a seed for benefiting something in the future. But the mother derives all her happiness by that fact that she's spending the time with the child, right? That is where all her joy comes from. Similarly, as devotees, yes, when we do bhajans, when we do meditation, when we do namasmarana, there is going to be some future benefit which will come. We may even start off thinking of that future benefit in our mind. But through this process, we have to graduate to the time where we enjoy the act itself, right? And this comes only when it is spontaneously out of love. This confusion comes in every stage. I'm not telling that this questioner is in a lower state of sadhana or anything like that. Please don't take me to mean that way. That's not what I'm saying. In fact, I'll give you an example which would happen when we were students here, and there would be always these periods of times when Swami would not talk to us, Swami would not come towards where we are sitting. So I remember that on one such occasion, we decided that after the aarti is over in the mandir, we all would sit together, a group of about 15-20 of us, and we would chant the Sai Gayatri 408 times. It was our way of saying that, Swami, we are pained by what we are doing. We want to please you, right? So this is what we used to do, 108 times we used to chant. So one of the elders in the ashram who came by and, you know, appreciated us for what we were doing, and then he said, but why are you chanting Sai Gayatri? You should chant the Gayatri Mantra, because the Gayatri Mantra is more powerful than the Sai Gayatri, and, you know, you should chant that. This again literally set the pigeons among, I'm sorry, the cat among the pigeons, because all of us said, some of us said, yeah, we should chant the Gayatri Mantra, and somebody else would come by and say that, no, there is some other, Lalita Sahasranamam, Vishnu Sahasranamam, that is more powerful, we should chant that. In the process, we are forgetting that here we were a few of us, who wanted to catch Swami's attention. And we knew that to catch Swami's attention, we must spend more time thinking about Swami. So if chanting the Sai Gayatri Mantra, we are able to think more of Swami with a lot of love and intensity, that is all it matters. It doesn't matter what you chant to get more power or to get more benefit out of it. So we all get into this thing. You know, even advanced people have spent many years with Swami, tend to do this thing that when we are following a certain routine in our sadhana, we see someone else and say that, oh, I want to do that. And this person is doing, early morning, he's getting up and chanting Vishnu Sahasranamam. I should also do that. Yes, you can change your sadhana. You can take up new ways of doing it. There are two reasons why we do that, because we always try to show ourselves that we want to give more time to Swami. So there's nothing wrong in that. But at the same time, let it always be driven by love for Swami and that intensity of love for Swami, and not what more benefit I will get. Like, for instance, you're asking me in this question, you said that your deity, your Ishta Devata is Amman or Mother Goddess, right? Why don't you really worship her as mother? You know, when you say that I would like to love my mother, I mean, you don't look around and say, who is the lady who is going to give me maximum benefit? I'm going to love her as my mother. It is not like that. It is like, here is my mother, and whatever she is able to give me, she may be a poor mother, she might be a sick mother, she may be a mother who can give me a lot of riches, or she can give me nothing. It doesn't matter. She is my mother, and I will worship her. And that is how our worship should be based on. And the reason why this happens, that why we start thinking that is it more beneficial to meditate upon Durga or is it more beneficial to meditate upon Saraswati? You know, I spoke of this quality of shubhecha, where the welfare of oneself is what drives us to spirituality. But the shubhecha that we all indulge in is actually slightly different. You know, what we generally do is, we worship God to protect our interests in the world. It is not self-interest which turns us to God. It's not like I want to progress spiritually, so I turn to God. It's not always like that. I have my interest in my world. I have my family, I have my children, I have my career. I want certain things to happen at certain points in time. I want certain things to happen smoothly. I don't want certain obstacles. I don't want pain. I don't want uncertainties. So it is to protect interest in this manner we turn to God, right? It's not wrong, because Swami says that at least this way you turn to God, if not for any other way. Instead of, you know, turning to the people around you, you're turning to God, and that is definitely praiseworthy. But when the method is used, what we actually do is we use God to attain the world, right? So when we do this, when we use God to attain the world or secure our situation in the world, the way we will judge whether our prayers are working or not will be through how things work out in life. So if I am worshipping a certain deity, I'm worshipping Lord Shiva or something like that, and I want to clear a particular entrance. 1 year I don't clear it, second year I don't clear it. So what am I doing? I'm using my worship of the Lord to ensure that I get a certain worldly success. So when I don't get that worldly success after a few attempts, I will think that maybe I should worship some other God, right? So that is what happens when we use God to attain the world. And there is this beautiful Chinnakatha which Swami would very often say, you know, about a man who starts worshipping Lord Shiva. He gets a small statue of Lord Shiva. He, you know, gives aarti every day, gives naivedyam every day. And he's a simple man who just wants to become rich. He has got a small business. He wants his business to flourish. It doesn't happen. So after a few months, he gets frustrated. He says, this Lord Shiva is not doing anything to me. So he, you know, takes the idol, puts it on the loft, and he gets a Krishna idol. Right? Now he starts worshipping this Krishna idol, sings bhajans to Krishna, offers naivedyam and all of that. And then 3 months pass, there is no improvement in his life. He gets frustrated. Swami says he takes the statue and he puts it on top. Then he gets a Ganesha idol. So he does this process all the time. Then finally Swami says that he has got another idol, probably of Sai Baba or something, Swami would say. So he is giving aarti and he's showing agarbatti to this idol, and he sees that the smoke of the agarbatti, which always goes upward, goes in the direction of the place where he has kept the statue of Lord Shiva, right? So then this man starts thinking, you don't answer my prayers, but you want the fragrance of the agarbatti, and you're drawing it towards yourself. So Swami says that this man, you know, climbs up and holds the nose of the statue of Lord Shiva. He says, dare you take the fragrance from the agarbatti because it's not being offered to you. And Swami would say that then Lord Shiva speaks out. He says, ah, finally you recognize me as an individual. I mean, as a person, you gave life to me. Right? All this while you treated me as an idol. At least in this manner, you actually treated me as a living entity. Right? So this is what we often do, because when we say that this is Mother Goddess, this is Amman, you know, when you say this is Amma, I mean, you're not going to ask yourself that which deity is better to worship as a mother. A mother is a mother. You know, whatever she is, whatever she gives, she doesn't give, she is your mother, right? And that is the attitude with which you will have to worship your mother. So it really doesn't matter which form you pick up, which name that you take. Om Shakti Om is, I guess, a perfectly, perfect name to do your namasmarana on. And you can think of any deity, right? But at some point, what we need to do is graduate from seeing what is the benefit I will get to, I'm doing it out of my love. You know, I love thinking about Swami. I love singing these Devaram songs. I love singing kirtans and bhajans, and I'm doing it out of my love. So start by choosing any form. Most people, what they do is they start with a family deity, right? That becomes very easy because everybody is worshipping a family deity in your family, and you pick up that deity. It doesn't really matter, right? And there are some other people who, through their childhood or their young adult age, they get attracted to a particular form. There are so many people who are actually born in a Hindu family, but who find a strange attraction towards Jesus Christ. There are many Christians who are drawn towards Lord Krishna. And sometime a few years ago, we spoke to an Anglican priest from South Africa who was very strangely drawn towards Lord Shiva. And Ramana Maharshi, for that matter, was so drawn when he first heard the name Arunachala, right? So if there is any form that is attracting you in that manner, Well, that would be perfect, because you're automatically being attracted due to some past connection with that particular form. You can worship that form. Don't ask yourself, is it okay to worship this form? Is it a lower form? Is it a lesser form? Right? This is for Namasmarana and bhajans and all of that. And you can certainly have different forms that you worship at different times. You know, when we sit for bhajans in Prashanti Nilayam, we all know the bhajan starts with the Ganesha bhajan, there's a bhajan for Krishna, there's a bhajan for Shiva, there's a bhajan on all the deities. So we are sitting there and visualizing different deities. Swami would often say that, you know, listen to the lyrics of the bhajan and imagine that form and that divinity. So we were actually visualizing different divine forms in that manner. In fact, even people who worship Swami, right, we always have this thing, what is the form of Swami that you have in your mind? There are some people who have a 25-year-old Swami, there are some people who have a 60-year-old Swami, and there are some people who, when they sit for bhajans and think of Swami, they are thinking of the Swami whom they saw in the 2005s and 2007s, when Swami was coming around in on a wheelchair, right? So even the form of Swami was different over the years, and different devotees think of different forms, and same devotees think of different forms. I think it doesn't matter. But when you talk about meditation, right, all of this is for Namasmarana and bhajans and kirtan. When you talk about meditation, and if you've taken up meditation as a task for stabilizing your mind, if you've taken it up as a sadhana that you do to bring one-pointedness in your mind, then yes, it is helpful. As I had mentioned before in that answer which I had given earlier, it helps if you pick one form and you constantly keep meditating on that one form. Because as Swami had explained, meditation is a three-step process. What we call meditation by sitting and closing eyes, it's not meditation at all. It is only a process which may eventually take us to that state of meditation. The true meditation, Swami says, is when the one who does meditation, the one whom he's meditating upon, and the act of meditation, all of these merge into one. That's the ultimate state, and Swami says that it does not come easily, it'll take a lot of effort. But we are in the process of meditation, Swami says, it's a three-step process. Concentration, contemplation, and meditation. And as I explained there, concentration is nothing but from multi-pointedness to one-pointedness, and that happens very easily when we fix our mind on one particular form. So it doesn't matter which form it is, choose one form if you've taken meditation as your spiritual sadhana. But as a devotee, as a worshipper, you can think of any form. You can think of Swami, you can think of Lord Shiva, you can think of any form which is appealing to you. And that is something which Swami constantly repeats many times. In fact, there I had explained that Swami says in the Dhyanavahini that contemplation becomes more easier when you bring this love aspect. When you have love for that form that you are contemplating on, contemplation and concentration becomes instantaneous, right? But for general contemplation on, it is not necessary to think of just one form, right? And that is precisely the reason why God comes down as an avatar. When the Lord comes, it is to help us to graduate from this state of we worshipping God, we having puja and prayers as a means to benefit ourselves in the world. We use God to attain things in the world. From this state, to help us graduate to that state where you look at Swami really as a mother, as a friend, as a companion. That happens when, you know, God comes down in the form of an avatar. That's what Swami says in the Bhagavad Vaini. God incarnates so that man can build a relationship with God. And when you build a relationship with God, it's not about which God is more powerful. Which God am I able to fall in love with, right? That's what really matters. So look at Swami as mother, look at Swami as a friend, and it really doesn't matter which image comes in your mind. As I said in another answer, I said the most important thing is love for God, and that love for God transforming us from within to love everybody around us the same way we love God. That is all that Swami will look for. And we've had innumerable experiences narrated by many, many devotees, how they said that the worship which was offered to any number of deities, all of that Swami showed that it reached him, right? We've ourselves mentioned many like that. I remember talking to one person who was worshipping Lord Subramanya, right? And when he came to Parthi, in some context, Swami had told a gathering that Swami was narrating some stories from the Ramayana, and the devotees were very wonderstruck. They said, "Swami, we've never heard this version of the story." And Swami said, "Yes, nobody knows. I know it because I was Lord Rama." Right? And Swami narrated a story from the Mahabharata, and again it was a very different story. And when asked, Swami said, "I know it because I was Lord Krishna." So this person goes back home and he thinks that, but I'm a worshipper, I worship Lord Subramanya, and here is Sai Baba who is saying that I'm Rama and Krishna. Probably I've come to the wrong address. You know, that's what he started thinking. And then he says that he has this dream where he has the vision of Lord Subramanya with his two consorts, Valli and Devyani, and he is standing in front of the three of them worshipfully, and he says that even as he's looking at the three of them, Lord Subramanya turns into an old man, whom he later realizes was Shirdi Baba. He had not known till then. So he becomes an old man, he's Shirdi Baba, and then he sees that all three of them start laughing, and the two consorts of Subramanya tell him that, you know, why are you showing this man the vision? He's a madman, he will not understand. And even as he's looking at the three of them, the old man now turns into Swami, and again they're all laughing. And this time the other consort says, why are you showing him this form, you know, this vision? He will not understand. So he wakes up from the dream and he says, oh my God, Swami is trying to drive the message that he is as well Subramanya as much as he is Rama, Krishna or Lord Shiva or whatever it is. There are many, many stories like this when there's a beautiful story of a devotee who was offering worship to his family deity. And he was offering tulsi leaves at what you call manasa puja, right? You sit and you imagine that you're doing the worship in the complete manner in your mind. And when he was doing that, Swami comes and he lifts his robe and he finds that the tulsi leaf was on Swami's feet. So Swami is saying that the worship that you offer to your Ishta Devata, to your family deity, has eventually reached me. And there's another story which I narrated a few weeks back about a doctor from Odisha who was worshipping a deity by name Sarla Mata, right? It's their local deity in their village. And Swami came in a dream and told that, you know, all your worship has reached me, so I've decided to come and solve your problem. So Swami constantly showed us this to prove to us that it doesn't matter which form we worship upon. And that is why for most of us Swami's devotees, it is so easy to meditate upon Swami's form, because that connection of love and bonding has already been established. So the only answer I'd give in summary is what I started with. There is no right and wrong in devotion. There is no good and bad. There is no lesser and higher in devotion. Whatever you are inspired to think of, whichever form you're inspired to think of, whichever name that you're inspired to take in worshipping the Lord, please do so. And be sure that it is definitely going to reach God, and Swami will respond not to the method, Swami will respond not to the technique, but Swami will respond to the intention, Swami will respond to the bhavam. As Swami says, God is bhavapriya and not bahyapriya. So that's the answer I wanted to give. Thank you for sending us that question. If there's anything more that you would like to ask me, you can always write to me at prem@radiosaya.org. So dear listeners, as you would have heard earlier in this morning's show, the Morning Glory, and what I mentioned, today happens to be the anniversary of the Vatavriksham in Prashanti Nilayam. And it's one of the most beautiful places in the ashram. Can you imagine, many, many years ago, I think sometime in the late 1950s, Swami was sitting in the Chitravati. Swami started speaking about great yogis like Gautama Buddha and how they would meditate upon some trees. And Swami went on to say that some of those trees actually had a yogic power. And even as he was saying that, he started drawing lines on the sands of Chitravati, and he brought out this copper plate which had inscriptions on it, some of it in known languages, most of it in unknown languages. Swami said, this is one, I think sasana is the word Swami uses, is one such plate. And under many of these trees under which these yogis meditated, such an object was there which gave that place that potency to give you peace when you sit and meditate under it. And Swami said that I am going to install this copper plate under one of the Vatavrikshams in the ashram, and people will come and benefit from it. And Swami, in fact, very, very categorically said that whoever comes and sits under this tree and meditates, he or she will attain peace and one-pointed concentration. That's a blessing which Swami has given. It's literally an open offer. And the tree still stands. People still go there. Even now, if you go there, you will see people sitting under it and meditating. So if you come to Prashant Nilayam, definitely that tree, that spot warrants a visit. So that is the history of the tree. The place itself is historic, isn't it? Prashant Nilayam, every spot has been sanctified by the presence of the Lord, and that is one more place. So today being the anniversary of the Vatavriksham, where Swami started that, gave this boon to mankind and inspired so many people to take to the path of devotion, I thought I'll read out one particular incident, an incident narrated by one of the former students about his adventures or misadventures, as you would like to call it, in the sadhana of meditation, and how Swami guided and trained them to take up these principles and these sadhanas in the right earnest. This is actually a narration by a student who studied in Old Vrindavan in the late 1970s. His name is Mr. Mayur Pandya. I think he is right now residing in Canada. This is an article which we have on the website. I'm going to read out a few paragraph passages from that. So this is what he says about his foray into meditation. So now I'll read out passages from that article. If he chastised on one hand, he also counseled and corrected. Yoga classes were an integral part of our hostel curriculum. In fact, after I had joined Swami's college, I learnt about Hatha Yoga, the various yogasanas, and also about Kundalini Shakti. So I was really fascinated by it. I read a lot on the subject, and I yearned for a mystic experience. Just around that time, Swami gave a luminous discourse about Jyoti meditation. I really took to it very seriously and set off on a determined mission of a transcendental expedition. At that time, the main hostel building was completely occupied, but the Essen Singh block next to that was free. So I would go into one of the empty rooms there, lock the door, light a candle, and sit down for meditation. Initially, the candle flame kept flickering, so I took a 200-paged hardcover notebook and positioned it like a V behind the flame so that the candle would not flicker and would continue to burn for at least an hour. Months passed. I still had not got that experience. Then one day, while I was meditating, the flame became brighter and brighter and much warmer. It got so hot suddenly that I opened my eyes thinking that this was the experience I was waiting for, only to see the cardboard, the candle, and everything caught up in flames. Evidently, the thick cover had caught fire, leaving behind only cinders of my unfulfilled aspirations. I was so thoroughly disappointed that I gave up the meditation altogether. One day, a few days later, I was standing in the portico along with 300 others waiting for Swami. Those were the portico sessions which were precursors to the Thrai session, where Swami would come down the stairs and spend a lot of time with the students in the portico, just before he went to the Sairam shed for darshan. Swami would stand there, joke with all of us, and would spend so much time. We would vie with each other to grab that fragrant green creeper with the flower which grew on the arches and offer it to Swami. And Swami would smell the creeper and give it back. That day, when Swami was standing in the portico, he suddenly said, "Hey Mayur, come here. Neeku nak ledura, nuvu crack aipotadu." That's what he said, meaning that you do not have the knack, you have become a crack. I was completely taken aback, wondering why Swami was calling me a crack in front of so many people. Then he called me closer and said, "If you go on staring at the candle, you are going to become a nervous wreck." After this, he gave a beautiful discourse for over an hour and a half on Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga. He spoke of the Eightfold Path to the Yoga and emphasized that the first foundation had to be very strong. Only then could one progress to the higher stages. This was really another telling incident of the Lord's omniscience. I was thrilled because I was doing some wrong sadhana or spiritual practice in a corner unknown to anyone. But Swami, who was aware of everything, corrected and taught me in his own unique way. So this was the incident narrated by Brother Mayur Pandya, a former student of Swami's university, who eventually completed his postgraduate and his PhD from Swami's university. But what a beautiful incident. You know, we all are enthusiastic. We have, as Swami says, the utsaham to do, the desire and the craving to do spiritual sadhana, but most of us are so naive, isn't it? But when that intention is pure to please Swami, when that intensity is pure, it becomes Swami's duty to step in and correct us, right? And this is so very relevant to the question I answered today also. It is not about which form we worship. It is not about what sadhana we do. It is all about the intention with which we do it. If we do it with a desire to please Swami, if we strongly believe that this is what Swami wants me to do and I will try my best, even if it is difficult, then when we are really doing something wrong, be absolutely certain that Swami will step in and correct us and guide us. Because nobody, let me repeat it, nobody wants that we reach Him and progress in this path more than Himself. So He will certainly take it upon Himself to come and guide us and to correct us if we are doing wrong in our spiritual practices. So that, dear listeners, brings me to the end of this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. Well, if you have a question on practical spirituality and you want it to be answered on this show, all you have to do it is write in a mail to prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID. You can write in your answers. You can send me a recording of your question, because that would be the perfect way, because I can play your question and then answer your question. If you wish to be anonymous, you're welcome to be so, because this is my personal mail ID and I'm the only person who's going to be reading your mails. You can mention that you would like your name not to be mentioned on the show. That could be managed. But let your questions be on practical spirituality, and together we will explore Swami's message for answers. I thank the person who asked us this question, and I most humbly offer the show at Swami's lotus feet. Do join me again next week for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth. But in about half an hour's time, I'll join you with Arvind for the afternoon satsang. I'm going to leave you with a bhajan which probably describes all that I said in the answer today. The bhajan, which is very famous, you all must be aware of it, where it says, chant any name, think of any form, but do it with love, do it with feeling. That's all that matters. So I'll leave you with this bhajan. On the other side of it, you will have Raghu's program, the Ashtotra Shatanamavali. And after that, I'll join you for the afternoon satsang. But next week at 11, I'll join you all for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth.
Govind Bolo, Gopal Bolo. Shama. महावीर बुद्ध नाम बोलो
बोलो गोपाल बोलो।